Roses in Istanbul, thorns at home. I hadn't officially moved in with Mum and Dad. I still kept my bed at Alan's place, my bolt hole. My name stayed registered with the Sidcup GP. I was under Queen Mary's for my hip operation, and there was no way I wanted anything to do with North Middlesex Hospital. That was my line in the sand, my last sliver of independence. But let's not kid ourselves, I was there all the time. Most days I'd wake up early, drag myself to the car, and make that slow crawl up to South London, commuting nearly daily down to see the boys, my friends, trying to hold on to what scraps of my old life I still had. And there were those hours at David Lloyd's in Dartford, sanctuary in chlorinated water, long steady laps that made me feel, for a little while, like I wasn't broken, like gravity had loosened its hold and my wrecked hips and knees couldn't scream at me. The pool was the only place I felt truly free. But the real reason I was there so much was simple. They needed me, even if they'd never say it, even if I was too wrapped up in my own failure to see it clearly at first. Being there worked, just showing up, sitting in that old front room with its sagging sofas and the ghost of 1,000 family arguments and celebrations in the walls, watching Dad potter about, fussing with receipts and bills he could barely read anymore, seeing Mum in her armchair, warm blanket over her knees, the flicker of the TV reflected in eyes that still held so much stubborn spark. They were in good spirits most days. Having me around seemed to anchor them. Even Dad, with his pride bristling like an old tomcat, calmed down when I was there. I tried to make sure there was fresh food every day. Simple stuff. Stir fries. Soups. One afternoon, I threw together rice with sliced veg and chicken in the wok I'd dug out of the back cupboard. He watched me with those hawk eyes of his, arms crossed, nose twitching at the smell. When I served it up, he actually said, deadpan, that it was better than Mum's. I knew it wasn't, but I took the praise like a kid clutching a gold star. He always liked to get out of the house, always had. So I'd bundle him into the car and take him with me on errands, trips to see Fred and Martin, quick pop-ins to Josh's or Remy's places. Sometimes I'd coax Mum into the car, too, and we'd drive them over to Richmond to see her brother, my Uncle Asen. Watching the two of them, white-haired and lined with a century of family history, talking in low, conspiratorial Turkish, brought a lump to my throat every time. I wanted to do more. God, did I want to do more. The hedge out front had grown wild, a solid green wall threatening to swallow the pavement whole. The fig trees in the back had exploded, branches clawing at the kitchen window like they wanted in. The vine had spread like an invading army, winding itself into the neighbor's fence, pulling at their garage roof like it was claiming new territory. But my body wouldn't let me. My hips and knees shrieked in revolt at the idea. That would have to wait for my boys. If I could lure them up to Cheshunt for a day of unpaid, grumbling gardening. But Ben had his own battles. My bankruptcy hadn't just sunk me. It had pulled him under too. His cafe franchise in Banstead gone. The council wouldn't even talk about renewing the lease under any name, but pistachios in the park littered. COVID had gutted the trade. Even the government's eat-out-to-help-out scheme couldn't tempt people back out in the numbers we needed. He was left unemployed. Ironically, Alina didn't seem to mind. Benefits. Rent support. He was home with the kids all day. But Ben? He was itching to work. So when EasyJet offered him a boarding crew job, he jumped at it like a drowning man at a lifeboat. Brutal shifts, though. 5 on, 3 off. 3 days starting at 5 a.m., home by midday, needing to be in bed before most people had even finished their dinner. The other 2 days he started mid-afternoon and staggered home at midnight. He was exhausted, but he loved it. No staff to pay, no suppliers breathing down his neck, no 7-day weeks on his feet in a cafe kitchen. He told me once, half asleep on my sofa, that for the first time in years, he didn't have the weight of the world pressing on his chest. He was hoping that if he kept his head down, worked hard, they'd see something in him worth promoting. Josh and Remy were getting busier too. They'd somehow landed work with Dino Don from the States, the guy who'd advised Spielberg on the original Jurassic Park, making sure the dinosaurs looked and moved right. Now Don was selling massive, animatronic dinosaurs to zoos all over Europe, trying to save them from closing their gates forever by luring crowds back in. And someone needed to assemble, repair, maintain those monsters. Josh had the know-how, the stubbornness. He taught himself welding, motor mechanics, electrics. He even roped Raimi in with him. Together they became the guys you called when your T-Rex wouldn't roar or your mammoth's fur was falling out in clumps. But Josh wasn't just working. He was building a life. He'd proposed to Toots, this bright, quick-witted Turkish woman who had a smile that could light up a whole room. She spoke Turkish with Mum and Dad whenever she visited, winning them over instantly. That meant the world to me, because I'd carried a promise for years. Just before Sally died, she pressed her 5-stone opal ring into my palm, told me to give it to Josh's future wife one day. I'd kept it tucked away, a tiny box holding so much weight. When I finally handed it over, Josh cracked, broke down in tears. Not the quiet, dignified kind either. The great heaving sobs of a man who'd been holding too much in for too long. Tuche was touched too. She wore it like it had always been meant for her. They set the date, October 17th, 2021, Istanbul. Mum and Dad were thrilled, genuinely lit up at the news. But they were also honest with themselves. They'd made it to Cyprus for Emel's wedding, Colombia for Temel's. But that was years ago. Even the old wheelchair days were better than now. They knew they couldn't do it. Couldn't face the airports, the transfers, the bone-deep fatigue of travel. They told me it was too hard, too much. I promised them I'd livestream every moment. They wouldn't miss seeing Josh get married if I had to hold the phone up the entire day. And it wasn't just me making the journey. My sister and her family planned to fly in from Cyprus. Martin and Fred would be there, two of the best mates a man could ask for. Alina, Ben, Remy, Josh's mates too. Jinish, Ed, Charlie, Matt, Osho, and Josh. His brothers from other mothers, who'd been there for him through every scrape and high and heartbreak. And Rory Glencourse. Best friend, best man. Sadly, my own brothers couldn't come. Ermin was back home in Australia, needed time to plan, to get time off work, and Alkin was fighting his own private battle. Ever since the COVID jab, his childhood eczema had roared back to life with a vengeance, his skin raw, cracked, weeping, too painful to even think about sitting on a plane for hours. But they were there in spirit. We all were. Because this wasn't just a wedding. It wasn't just another day in the calendar. It was hope. It was the proof that even after everything, bankruptcy, broken bodies, broken promises, family still mattered, love still mattered. It was the reason I kept going. All the mistakes, all the losses. Because some things are worth fighting for. Some things are worth enduring the pain. And watching my son slip that opal ring onto the finger of the woman he loved, that was one of them. Remy took on the job of sorting our accommodation, and he didn't just do well, he outdid himself. We flew out on the 14th of October and stayed until the 21st. Josh and Rory were already there weeks ahead of us, tangled in the details of planning a wedding in a city that feels like the entire world in one place. Istanbul, where Europe and Asia brush shoulders and every street feels like a crossroads of history. It felt unreal, leaving England behind. Pipuk Lidded stepped up to help with costs, not just for the wedding itself, but for our flights, our rooms. It felt like a last act of solidarity from a business that had seen better days. When we arrived, we were greeted by the sight of our temporary home, a modern, glass and steel tower rising in the old leather factory district, an area that had transformed from industrial husk into something slick and fashionable. Our apartment was on the 18th floor. It wasn't just big, it was posh. Marble floors, clean lines, floor-to-ceiling windows that offered dizzying views of the city skyline, lit up at night like 100,000 lanterns. The building itself was more like a luxury resort. In the basement, an indoor pool that glowed turquoise under mood lighting, a proper Turkish hammam, sauna, steam room, all there for us to use, no extra charge. For a week, we were living like sultans, and after the year I'd had, it felt like a reprieve sent straight from heaven. Sleeping arrangements fell into place easily. Ben and Alina were the only couple, so they got the master bedroom with the ensuite that felt like something out of a boutique hotel. Raimi claimed the second bedroom. Martin and Fred, like an old married couple at this point, shared the third. And me? I was happy to spread out on the enormous sectional couch in the living room. It was so plush you practically sank into it, and after everything, I didn't care about privacy. The first morning in Istanbul, before the sky had even properly turned gray, we were jolted awake by the haunting, soaring wail of the call to prayer. It wasn't the countryside crow of a rooster, though you'd hear those too, strutting along tiled roofs like they owned them. This was something older, stranger, more profound. It poured from a crackling loudspeaker perched on a minaret somewhere in the maze of rooftops around us, rippling through the cold dawn air in waves of sound. The muezzin's voice rose and fell, lilting and sonorous, cutting across the rumble of early traffic and the distant horns of ferries on the Bosporus. For a moment, lying there on my borrowed couch in that sleek apartment, I felt suspended between worlds. Outside, the city was waking slowly, lights flickering on in flats, shutters rattling open, bakers stoking ovens. But that voice from the minaret seemed to stitch the modern chaos to something ancient, something sacred. It felt mystical, like Istanbul itself was breathing in time with the prayer, like centuries were layered on top of each other and we were lying somewhere in between them, half guests, half intruders in a place that would outlast us all. Even groggy, half blind with sleep, I listened. Let it wash over me. Fred snorted awake as he came into the living room, muttering, "What the bloody hell is that?" in that South London drawl of his, which made me laugh quietly into my pillow. But I didn't answer. I didn't want to spoil it, because it was magic in its way. A reminder we were somewhere else entirely, somewhere with its own rules, its own rhythms, its own beauty. And even though we'd come for a wedding, this modern, personal celebration of love and family, it struck me that this city had seen millions of such unions, that this call to prayer had broken across thousands of mornings just like this, as grooms and brides lay awake with nerves or excitement or fear. It was humbling. It felt right. And even when it ended, tailing off in that final shivering note that left the city quiet for a heartbeat, I lay there for a long time, listening to the hush it left behind, and I thought, we're here. We made it. And today is the first day. Every morning, like clockwork, Alina would head out before any of us even thought about stirring. She'd wander the maze of side streets, returning with warm, crusty bread, fresh fruit shining with morning dew, olives, cheeses, and tiny pastries sticky with syrup. Then she'd lay it all out on the table, setting out plates, pouring coffee, slicing fruit. Watching her bustle around, hair still tussled from sleep, humming quietly. I won't lie, I felt something soften in me. A kind of old fondness. Even Martin noticed. He nudged me once and whispered with a wink, "She's looking after us better than my mother used to." Ben seemed happier too, relaxed in a way I hadn't seen in ages. It was like for a few brief mornings, all the weight of the last year lifted off our shoulders and we were just family again, having breakfast high above Istanbul. Josh's mates, Janesh, Ed, Charlie, Matt, Osho, and the other Josh, arrived the next day. They were full of energy and jokes, and it was like adding petrol to an already lively fire. They stayed closer to the wedding venue, right in the beating heart of Beşiktaş, the football-obsessed district, close enough to hear the roar of the stadium on match day. Turns out Tuç's parents lived in the same neighborhood. Her mother was a dyed-in-the-wool Beşiktaş fan. "If you weren't born into it," she told us half-serious, "you're not a real supporter." Her dad, though, was Galatasaray, a rivalry so fierce you could write whole novels about it. Luckily, he was more philosophical than fanatical, so their house wasn't a daily battleground of football arguments. That first evening, we all piled into one of the countless bars lining the district's tangled streets. The air smelled of grilled meats, cigarette smoke, and the tang of raki spilled onto sticky tables. Josh and Tuça made plans for me to meet her parents properly the next day. Her mum had recently retired, burned out after decades in the corporate world, the stress carved into the lines on her face. Her dad was semi-retired too, but he couldn't bear full idleness, so he managed a jazz bar for a friend a few nights a week. A job that meant his friend got a break without worrying the place would burn down in his absence. That jazz bar, smoky and atmospheric with old photos on the walls and the low hum of a piano in the corner, would end up hosting the wedding dinner. It felt right. Intimate. Authentic. I'd been to Istanbul before with Martin and Fred, back when I was lighter on my feet. We'd done the tourist rounds, the Blue Mosque with its vast, echoing interior that felt like standing inside a giant lantern, the chaotic, colorful fish markets on the Bosporus, the Grand Bazaar with its scent of spices and leather, the Topkapı Palace where sultans plotted and courtiers whispered. Fred and I even had a proper Turkish bath that trip. I remember him in the next booth, shrieking with giggles as his bather scrubbed him like an old rug. Afterwards, he emerged beet red but grinning, saying he hadn't felt that clean since his mum bathed him as a toddler. Even now, with my hips screaming at me for every step, I loved it. Istanbul is not a gentle city. It's hills and cobbles, uneven pavements and staircases where you least expect them. Rimi and Ben were saints. They'd let me lean on them, take my arm without asking, steadying me over every treacherous curb. Martin and Fred did the same. Josh's mates, too, treated me with unspoken respect. Not pity, just the kind of easy helpfulness that made me want to hug them all. That apartment was our refuge. Come late evening, we'd descend to the pool, which seemed to glow like some gemstone in the dim lighting. The rule about swimming caps was enforced with near religious zeal. No cap, no swim. But we didn't care. We'd splash about, float under the high ceiling, let the water take the weight off our bones. Then the sauna and steam rooms would boil the aches out of us. We joked we were all turning Turkish by the end of it. Transport to the wedding venue was another adventure. Our place was a cab ride away from Beşiktaş, which seemed sensible, until match day. That Sunday, Beşiktaş were at home, and the traffic gridlocked like it had been cemented in place. We'd timed it for 2 p.m., ceremony at 3 p.m. sharp, another wedding booked for 3:30 p.m., cutting it close, even in ideal traffic. I remember Martin, Fred, and me sitting in the back of the cab checking our watches every 30 seconds, Martin muttering curses, Fred joking to keep us calm. I kept glancing at the phone, my stomach in knots. We made it with minutes to spare. Josh's face when he saw us, relief fighting with that familiar exasperation that said, "Don't you dare make me go through this without you." He probably thought I'd flake out like I did at Ben's wedding all those years ago. But I was there. Phone in hand, streaming the whole ceremony live to Mum and Dad back in Çeşhunt, watching them smile on the screen, tears in their eyes as Josh and Tuça spoke their vows. Seeing my son slip his mother's opal ring onto his bride's finger, a promise fulfilled after all these years. My heart felt like it would burst. My sister couldn't come. She'd picked up some bug while holidaying in Cyprus. But her husband Sami, their daughter Emel, Len her husband, and little Roman made it, making sure our side of the family was represented. Before the evening dinner, they'd arranged a boat party on the Bosporus. We danced on deck, music thumping, the city drifting past in lights and shadow. The wedding cake came out, everyone singing. Martin, old sailor that he is, was practically in tears at being back on the water, his face lit by the glow of the city and the Bosporus Bridge arching over us like a promise. Then came the sit-down meal, the speeches. Rory, the best man, had been forced to show Tuça his speech in advance. She had it vetted and translated to Turkish by one of her friends to make sure it wouldn't embarrass anyone. She gave him the go-ahead. But Rory being Rory, he went off script, abandoned the safe version entirely, and launched into childhood tales, including an absolute belter about a Hoover incident that had the entire English-speaking side of the room crying with laughter. Tuça's face went to thunder, eyes like daggers at Rory, but her friend who was translating skipped that bit entirely, ad-libbing something safe so her parents were none the wiser. The next night, it was just me, Josh, Tuça, her mum and dad, and her brother, sitting in a beautiful restaurant by the water, the Bosporus Bridge lit like a string of pearls in the night sky, a vast mosque rising luminous behind us. We talked about family, about life. I listened to Tuça's parents speak about their hopes for their children, their fears, their joys. I couldn't have asked for better in-laws for my son. They were kind, real. They welcomed me like family. "Tell your mum I love her." When we finally got back from Istanbul, I was still buzzing, like I was carrying a little pocket of that city's energy around in my chest. I couldn't wait to share it all, to relive every moment, as if telling it out loud might keep it alive just a bit longer. So I sat with my mum, dad, and with Alkan, all of us huddled around the table, flicking through hundreds of photos on my phone. I narrated every detail, the laughter, the boat on the Bosporus, the way Josh looked when he slipped Sally's opal ring onto Tuca's finger. You could see it in their eyes, that glimmer of pride and longing, as if they were right there with us, instead of stuck in that tired little house in Cheshunt. And even after all those hours traveling home, I still felt giddy, still floating on that high. I made Tuch's mum promise that next time I came back, she'd take me to a proper Besiktas match. Josh had told me the atmosphere was electric, spine-tingling, he said, and he doesn't even like football. I vowed to go again, and I swore to myself that next time I'd be walking properly, not hobbling along on my stick, wincing with every step. The way I looked, standing on street corners in Istanbul, I half expected someone to toss Turkish lira into my hand out of pity. But coming home meant dropping straight back into reality. I'd only been gone a week, and already the place looked like it had missed me. The kitchen counters were littered with takeaway cartons and dirty mugs. The little side tables in the front room were piled high with junk mail, biscuit wrappers, bits and bobs my dad couldn't bear to throw away. At least we'd managed to get some help in place through Hertfordshire Council. Twice a day, carers turned up at the door, their voices always too loud, too bright for that weary house. About 8 each morning, they'd help Mum wash, measure out her tablets, coax her to eat something. Dad was meant to get help too, but he refused to let anyone near him with a flannel. Too proud. He insisted he could do it himself, even though half the time he hadn't even gone to bed, just drifted in and out of sleep in his chair, still wearing yesterday's clothes. It was becoming impossible to ignore how fast he was slipping. Sometimes he'd clutch my arm, eyes darting around the room like he didn't recognize it, and say, "I feel funny." And that was it. No explanation. Just that. We spent too many nights in A&E at North Middlesex. The same routine, over and over. Hours on those hard chairs that the air stale with other people's worries. They'd check his blood pressure, take his vitals, and every time he'd perk up when the doctor came, make a bit of small talk, insist he was fine and we'd be sent home none the wiser. One night stays with me more than the others. I'd planned a proper evening, curry at the very best in Eltham with Don and Alan, a night of food and laughter. Maybe I'd even stay over and feel for a few hours like I wasn't just a full-time carer with a bad hip and a failing bank balance. But it never happened. Just a couple of hours in, my phone started buzzing in my pocket. I knew before I answered it. My dad's voice was thin, frayed with fear. "Asen, I feel funny. I'm going to die. Please, come." That was that. Curry night over before it began. I made my excuses, drove straight back to Cheshunt, and walked in to find him slumped in his chair. The smell hit me. Here is the clean chapter prose. First, sour and familiar. His trousers were soaked through. His eyes were glazed. He looked so small, so utterly lost. I cleaned him up, tucked Mum safely into bed, then bundled him into the car and took him to A&E again. We got there at 10 that night. We didn't see a doctor until 2 the following afternoon, 14 hours in fluorescent purgatory. He was never a patient man, even before the dementia, and this was torture. He complained over and over about how long it was taking, how he was starving. At one point, the mother of another patient offered him an untouched, unopened sandwich she'd pulled from her bag, trying to be kind. But he wasn't having it. He let rip, full Catherine Tate's Nan. "What? You think I can't afford my own fucking sandwich?" His voice boomed across the waiting room. People stared. I was mortified, apologized over and over, bundled him out to the 24-hour McDonald's, fed him, and took him back. They didn't even know we were gone. When we finally got seen, they told us he had a urine infection, handed over a prescription for antibiotics, and sent us on our way. But it didn't stop there. The infections came one after the other, the ambulances too. Sometimes he'd be admitted, but halfway through treatment, he'd start telling me he wanted to leave, that he was fine. He'd look at me with that pleading desperation, and I'd always end up signing him out, even though I knew it wasn't the right thing. I tried to keep hold of something that felt like my own life. Josh was moving into a new house in Catford, renting from a mate, and needed furniture. I looked at the bed I'd kept at Alan's, the last little piece of a safety net I pretended was still there, and realized how pointless it was. So I gave it to Josh. But no matter where I went or what plans I made, there was always that invisible rope around my waist, pulling me back to Cheshunt. I couldn't stay away too long. One afternoon, I tried to steal an hour for myself, drove to Manor House Gardens to see Don, just to have a chat, just to feel normal for a bit. And there I ran into Juliet, an old customer from the cafe days. She clocked the stick right away, that look of pity flickering across her face before she could hide it. I tried to laugh it off. "Abused my body too long," I said. "Got so heavy I'm waiting on bariatric sleeve surgery. Hips need replacing too, but they won't touch me until the weight comes off." The bloke she was with looked up, said he'd had the sleeve himself and it was the best thing he'd ever done. Lost so much weight, felt like he'd got his life back. My ears pricked up. "Where? Turkey?" I asked. "No," he said, smiling. "Cyprus. Kyrenia." My heart thumped. Cyprus, my birthplace. It felt like a sign. He gave me the surgeon's name, Verol, and that night I looked him up. The reviews were good. People said he'd changed their lives. But of course, it cost. Thousands. Money I didn't have. Here on the NHS it was free, even if the wait was endless. My orthopedic surgeon, Mr. Ahmed at St. Mary's in Sidcup, understood the toll the pain was taking on me. He could see how desperately I needed the hip operation, and he treated me not just as another patient, but as someone whose life had been put on hold. Wanting to help in any way he could, he wrote directly to the bariatric clinic in Chichester, urging them to place me on their cancellation list. It felt like a lifeline, his way of saying, "I see what you're going through, and I'm going to fight for you to get there faster." I phoned the hospital in Chichester, asked if they'd had the consultant's letter, if I was officially on the cancellation list. "Yes," they told me, "but you're still looking at over a year." Had I considered going private? How much? £14,000. They even offered credit, a monthly payment plan. I just laughed. "I'm bankrupt," I told them. "No one will give me credit." And that was that. At least I knew. I resigned myself to it. Keep swimming, keep waiting. Meanwhile, my dad was getting worse. It felt like every week I was calling 999. One day they took him in again, and when I walked up to his cubicle, I saw his slippers lying in a puddle of urine. His bed was empty. Then I spotted him, shuffling back from the toilet, head down, unshaven, one hand clutching the IV stand. His trousers were soiled again. He didn't even know. The nurses were all busy, heads down, nobody seeing him. I watched, frozen, as he headed straight for that puddle, picturing him slipping, breaking a hip, or worse. "Dad, stop!" I shouted, my voice cracking. He froze on the spot. I rounded on the nurses, voice shaking with anger I'd been swallowing for months. I demanded someone help him. Demanded they see to him. They looked at me, blank and tired, and one of them nodded. Apologized in that automatic way that means nothing. I stood there, watching them clean him up, and for the first time I filed a formal complaint. Of course, it went nowhere. No reply, no apology. But deep down I knew it wasn't really their fault. The NHS was crumbling, falling apart under the weight of everything asked of it. Underpaid, understaffed, overworked. And still, somehow, we all clung to the idea it was the best health service in the world. All I knew was it wasn't good enough for him. Not for my dad. It was my first Christmas without Diane. December 2023. I found myself living at my mum and dad's place, even if I pretended it was just staying over. But let's be honest, I'd all but moved in. Christmas didn't exist in their house. Not even a hint. They were Muslim, and for them, December 25th was just another day on the calendar. No turkey, no tree, no garland over the mantelpiece. Same old net curtains that had yellowed with age. The carpet worn thin in the doorway. The air heavy with the smell of cooked onions and stale memories. I missed it so much I could taste it. I'd find myself replaying Christmases with Diane over and over in my head, even when it hurt like hell. She always made the place look like something out of a glossy magazine. The tree wasn't just a tree, it was a showpiece, each bauble deliberately placed, lights threaded so they glowed warmly in the dark. Garland twisting up the banister, white fairy lights casting their cold glow over the hedges outside, like a lit-up fortress of holiday cheer. It wasn't just the look of it, it was the feeling. That comforting clatter in the kitchen. The smell of turkey roasting for hours. Kids tearing open paper and squealing with joy. That sense of family, messy, noisy, alive. Now I was just there on my mum and dad's settee. I sat there listening to the wind whisper and rattle through the tangled branches of the old fig and apricot trees in the back garden, their leaves scraping against the glass like skeletal fingers, telling myself over and over that I didn't need any of it. But this year, I swore it would be different. Remy and Josh were renting a shoebox of a flat on the Cater estate in Blackheath. You couldn't swing a cat in it without knocking something over. But they didn't care. They were genuinely excited, because for the first time in years, it was going to be me and my three boys together on Christmas Day. It felt special, almost like reclaiming something we'd lost. Back when I was living in Eastbourne with Diane, they only made the trip once, and after that, never again. They couldn't face it, didn't want to see her. And Ben, Christ, Ben was in pieces, homeless, technically, crashing on sofas. His life had blown apart the minute we got back from Istanbul. 1 week we were all sailing on the Bosporus, laughing, taking pictures with Alina smiling on his arm, sharing a bed, acting like a couple in love. Days later she told him she didn't love him, that she hadn't for months. She wanted a divorce, and she didn't do it gently. She told him to get out. The flat was hers. She wanted him gone immediately. He rang me, voice shredded. He couldn't understand it, kept asking how. How do you fake something like that so well? He clung to those memories like they were proof it couldn't be true. I tried to console him, but inside I was seething. Not just at her, at myself. She'd played me too. Come to Istanbul on our coin. Enjoyed the wedding, the sights, the shopping. Just like Morocco years ago, when I took them to Fez, thinking I was helping them build a future. She was smiling, calculating. Promises she'd work hard, pay me back. Lies, all of it. Deep down, I suspected she'd planned this for months. Maybe even filed the divorce papers before Josh and Tucci even said I do. And I felt sick knowing my bankruptcy had cost Ben his cafe. Without that, maybe he'd still have had a chance to hold on to her. It made me hate women. Not all of them. Not Sally. She would have stayed even if I lost everything. Even if I was sleeping in a shop doorway. To her, to death do us part actually meant something. But Diane? Alina? When things got tough, they bolted, raised the drawbridge, and left us out in the cold. Diane used to say Alina was manipulating Ben to keep my wallet open. I thought she was paranoid. Now I wondered if she'd been right all along. They were both masters at it. Beautiful, smiling, and calculating, and I was just another fool who fell for it. So this year I wasn't going to let Christmas pass like that. I didn't care how cramped their flat in Blackheath was. I'd make it work. Dad seemed stable for now, no infections. I'd fill the fridge, prep the meals, lied to myself it would be fine if I was gone a day. And then Fred did something that brought a lump to my throat. He rang me up. He knew everything that had happened, how Ben was crashing with anyone who'd have him, how I was living half my life in Cheshunt. And he said, "Listen, I've got the place to myself. Plenty of room. Come here for Christmas. Stay the night if you want. Bring the boys. They're family to me, too." It floored me, because Fred meant it, so we did. Christmas Day that year was magic, the kind you don't think you're ever going to have again once life has ripped so much from you. I had my boys around me, Josh with Tucce, Remy with Kate, his girlfriend, Ben, battered but there, Fred, and even Manjeet, another stray with nowhere to go on Christmas Day, who was so happy to have a place at the table. Fred and I got up early, made breakfast for everyone, the smell of bacon and eggs filling that quiet house. Then we turned our attention to the turkey, basted it, slid it in the oven for 3.5 hours, peeled the veg. Fred even made his vegetarian meatloaf, like only he could. We even had time to nip to the local for a quick pint. Me, my boys, and Fred raising a glass to getting through another year. When we sat down to eat, the room was full of noise and laughter. Jokes flying, plates being passed around, Fred cracking wise, the boys giving it back. It felt like a real Christmas. But I won't lie, my mind would slip. Drift off to Eastbourne. I'd wonder what Diane was doing. Was her tree still perfect? Did she miss me at all? But even with that ache, I knew this was the best Christmas I'd had in years. Being there with my sons, with a true friend Fred, who had taken us all in without a second thought. I missed seeing my grandkids, of course. Missed watching their faces light up, tearing open their presents. And I thought of Ben, the rawness of what he must have felt that day, separated from his girls, just 5 and 4 years old. They'd been inseparable, and yet Alina had managed to break even that. But that day, we had Christmas. Not the polished fairy-lit version, but the real thing. Family. Friends. And the knowledge that even after everything life had stolen from us, it couldn't take that. By Boxing Day, the magic was over. It ended as quickly as it had begun. Ben was back at work at EasyJet, grinding through those brutal shifts because he had no choice. The newlyweds, Josh and Toots, had peeled away for some much-needed us time, probably trying to salvage a little romance and peace after the chaos of family. Remy and Kate were off somewhere else entirely, partying with their friends, and Fred, he went back to work, as he did every year, opened up his cafe for Christmas dog walkers and parents dragging new bikes behind ecstatic kids. He never did a big hot meal, just coffee and cakes, but it was his tradition. He always said he liked to give people somewhere to go. Me? I headed back to Cheshunt. The car was quiet, the heating blasting to chase the December chill. My mind was still warm from the day before. Those jokes, that laughter, the feeling of belonging. But underneath it was that hollow, gnawing ache I couldn't shake. I felt lost, sad, helpless. Because for someone who always preached about family values, who tried so damn hard for everyone else to be happy, I'd been blind for years. Blind or maybe just trapped. Was it all for them? Or was it for me? Building the business, the brand, Pistachios in the Park was meant to be my pension, my security, my legacy, something to protect me in old age. And now it was gone. Ashes, what now? I pulled onto my parents' drive and took a deep breath. My mom and dad were thrilled to see me, though. You'd think I'd been gone for months, not a single night. My dad's welcome was so intense it nearly undid me. His eyes lit up in that childlike way dementia had given him, and he squeezed my hand so hard I thought it would crack. The new year came too fast. If I'd been able, I'd have driven into London to stand among the crowds on the South Bank, watch the fireworks burst over the Thames, listen to Big Ben chime in with all the other hopeful souls. But I wasn't agile enough. I wasn't that man anymore. Instead, the weeks and months that followed fell into a grinding routine. My dad's I feel funny episodes kept happening. Sometimes vague and panicked, other times cold with dread. He'd beg me to call an ambulance, only to refuse to get in once it came. Or he'd go sit for hours in A&E, flirt with the nurses, tell the doctors jokes, then get sent home with nothing to show for it but exhaustion. Until his GP finally said enough. They put him on the hospital at home scheme. A dedicated nurse came regularly, able to check vitals, administer antibiotics through a drip without him leaving the armchair he slept in most nights. It seemed like a godsend at first. But one weekend, I sat opposite him, watching him talk to insects I couldn't see. He curled up in that chair like a child, eyes wide and shining. "They're all around me, Ison," he whispered, voice conspiratorial. "Watch your feet. They're coming to get 'em." I froze. I couldn't see anything. I called my brother Alcan in Reading, held the phone up so he could see Dad's vacant, flickering eyes, hear the disjointed rambling. I recorded it, even though it felt like a betrayal. I needed someone to witness it with me. And then came March. On the 7th, the nurse arrived for his regular visit. The moment he opened the door, he recoiled. He'd soiled himself again. There was a foul, clinging stench that seemed to live in the walls. He hadn't showered in weeks. When he tried to clean him, he resisted, slapped his hands away like a child refusing medicine. He pulled me aside, voice low. "Your dad needs to be in a home." I felt my mouth go dry. He went on. "I think he has another infection. He needs to go to hospital, now." I swallowed the lump in my throat and called 999. When the paramedics came, Dad turned into a hurricane. He screamed, he raged, he cried, he refused to go. "No, I'm not going. If I go, I won't come back alive. Ason, tell them." I tried to calm him, begged, promised, but he wouldn't listen. He refused to go to North Middlesex. He hated it there, and I didn't blame him. So the paramedics agreed, reluctantly, to take him to Harlow, to Princess Alexandra instead. I left my mum at home alone, heart heavy, and followed them. That night I sat by his hospital bed until dawn, watching him hooked up to IV antibiotics. They thought it was another UTI, but his blood work was stubbornly inconclusive. A young doctor sat down next to me, eyes gentle but firm. "Your dad's dementia is really advanced now," he said quietly. "When he's discharged, you should think about a care home." I felt something split inside me. I explained it wasn't just my decision to make, that my brothers and sister had to agree. But the truth was, I couldn't imagine it. Couldn't imagine telling my dad he wouldn't be going home. He'd been with my mom 67 years. Being apart from her would kill him faster than any infection. We needed to talk. all of us. But while I sat there wrestling with that, things at home were falling apart. My mom, alone, went upstairs in her stairlift, unhooked the seatbelt at the top, and tried to get off. She tripped and fell, bruised her coccyx. Thank God for the panic button on her wrist. She pressed it, and the emergency services arrived in minutes. North Middlesex Hospital again. So now I had both of them in two different hospitals. Two sets of visiting hours. I made the mistake of telling Dad. He understood enough to start crying, begging the nurses to discharge him so he could be with her. This time, I told myself, I'll be strong. He wasn't being discharged. Not this time. Even though the blood tests didn't show the infection they were sure he had, even though he kept insisting he was fine. I found myself bouncing between hospitals, morning to tea time with Mum, then racing to Harlow to sit by Dad's bed. One afternoon at Harlow Hospital, we managed a family meeting over Skype. My sister was with me at Dad's bedside. My brothers dialed in, the doctor joined us. That day Dad was lucid, ate his lunch, said it was his favorite, smiled at us. He kept telling us to leave. Go see your mum, he said. She needs you more than I do. It almost broke me in two. When the doctor came, he said the confusion was probably from the infection, even though last time he'd told me there wasn't any sign of it in the blood work. If he keeps improving, he said, voice so certain it made me want to believe, he could be home by Friday, the 8th of March. I clung to that, happy, relieved, dropped my sister home, then headed straight to North Middlesex to see Mum. She was smiling too, for one fragile moment. It felt like things might be okay again. But even as I sat by her side, I could feel the ground shifting under my feet. Like no matter how hard I held on, everything was still threatening to slip away. I arrived on the Friday with Josh, early as usual. I was expecting my dad to be discharged that day. In my head, I was already planning it. Depending on how he was feeling, maybe we'd even be able to drive straight over to North Middlesex Hospital and visit my mum. She was still in there, sore and miserable, with a severely bruised coccyx after her fall. They weren't talking about sending her home yet, either. They wanted to run more tests, figure out why she kept feeling dizzy and passing out. My money was on blood pressure again, but they were being thorough. No talk of discharge, no plan for release. But after yesterday, seeing my dad sit up in that hospital bed eating his meal and even praising the food, I was hopeful. I kept telling myself this time the UTI would stay gone for a while. Maybe this would be the reset he needed. When we got to the ward, though, everything in me sank. His curtains were drawn around his bed, never a good sign. I pulled them back gently and there he was, lying small and twisted on that bed, an oxygen mask strapped over his mouth and nose. His breath came in thin, desperate rasps, his chest heaving like he was trying to haul in the whole room. He looked so frail, so weak. Mad to think that only yesterday he'd been upright, joking, eating lunch like it was no big deal. I spun to the nurse and snapped, "What happened? Yesterday he was fine." She gave me that professional nurse's calm, the one that's meant to reassure but doesn't. "He picked up another infection overnight," she said, "a chest infection this time. But don't worry, we caught it early. The oxygen is helping." When he heard my voice, his eyes cracked open, cloudy and wet, and he tried to smile. He fumbled the mask off with trembling fingers and managed to croak, "How's your mum? Did you see her?" It broke me. I squeezed his hand. "I'm going later. I was hoping we'd go together, you old goat. But looking at you now, that's not happening, is it?" The nurse leaned over gently and said, "Mehmet, you need the mask on," and eased it back over his face while he weakly protested. I turned to her, my voice shaking with frustration. "How the hell does that happen? He had a urine infection. You treated it, and now he's got a lung infection? How is that even possible?" She looked tired, worn down by too many hard truths. "Your dad's weak," she said. "Hospitals are full of infections. He's vulnerable to anything in the air, but he's responding well. Try not to worry too much. Try not to worry." I sat there for hours anyway, refusing to leave. I held his thin, papery hand and talked about nothing and everything. Josh sat with us too, telling him all about what he and Toos were up to. Said he missed coming over, that he'd be back soon to finish laying the new lino in the downstairs toilet, help me prune the trees in the back garden. Dad blinked and rasped through the mask, "Don't worry, I'll do the trees when I come home." It hit me so hard I could barely speak. Eventually, we had to go. We still needed to see Mum, and I had to get Josh back to Lewisham. I kissed Dad on the forehead before we left. I'll be back tomorrow, old man. Rest up. Saturday, I went to see my mum first. She was miserable, stuck in that hospital bed, angry at her body for betraying her. Then I went to Dad. He was worse. He looked terrible, sunken, gray. He could barely whisper, let alone talk. But I stayed, all through visiting hours, not wanting to leave him alone. Sunday, he seemed a bit better, a tiny spark of life back in his eyes. He didn't want me to go. He clutched my hand and said in that ragged voice, "I'm gonna die in this hospital."